Hubert Saleur in near Paris,
and two guys there around Europe, Italian guys. So orthogonality catastrophe is, we all heard about it, at least I heard when I was undergrad, but I never really understood what was catastrophic about it, or never quite understood the point. So basically Anderson, 40 years ago, more than 40 years ago, in 1967, did a simple calculation. He measured, he took the ground state of a free fermionic system, was called Slater, people used to call this state Slater determinant in those times, and then calculate the same ground state where you modify your system just by adding an impurity at a certain point. So you slightly modify your system, and then he computed the overlap, so the scalar product between these two states, and he found out that the scalar product, as you reach the thermodynamic limit, so as you increase number of particles or size of your system, the scalar product tends to zero at infinity, so in the thermodynamic limit. So this was, for some reason, was disturbing him, and so he called it catastrophic. So I think nowadays we understand this idea, this behavior much more. Just think of a simple quantum information exercise of computing the fidelity of a random guess, right? You have two states, you take two states at random in a Hilbert space of dimension d and compute the scalar product. On average, the scalar product is 1 over d. So if you have, you know, qubit system, this scalar product is exponentially small in the system size, okay? The volume, if you want. So what I will do is to show that, in fact, this behavior, this simple back of the envelope calculation, is in fact quite general, and the deviation are at critical points, and I will show how this deviation actually occurs. But so this business of calculating scalar product of many-body states, so that was used by Anderson the first time, it has very many consequences. So it has many, I will try to show that it has many applications in many areas of physics. And it led Paolo Zanardi to formulate a new approach to quantum critical points. So this is what I'm going to review. Maybe, I don't know if some of you already heard a seminar about Paolo Zanardi's result on this fidelity. So I will try to be a bit quick on this topic. So the idea is very simple, okay? This slide was supposed to come before this slide, but fine. So this is more or less the standard approach to quantum phase transition, okay? I'm speaking mostly of second order phase transition, also called continuous phase transition. So somehow you calculate your free energy, or if you're at zero temperature, you calculate the ground state energy. This holds both for classical or quantum system, doesn't really matter. And then you calculate, if your system has some critical point, you expect that some derivative of your thermodynamic potential will show a divergence. Here, it's very common to consider the second derivative, which is the susceptibility, and it has this form, okay? So this scenario, sometimes it also implies that you have to pin down the right operator here where you have to compute the susceptibility. So you want to single out the other parameter and so forth. So the idea of Paolo Zanardi was very simple, and to replace these things by this simple scalar product, which is reminds of Anderson's idea. So what's the idea? Very simple. Let's say I have my system. Let's concentrate for a second on zero temperature quantum mechanics. So I have a Hamiltonian which depends on a set of parameters, and I calculate, let's say, the ground state with certain parameters, and then I can calculate the ground state with other parameters, okay? And I compute this overlap. So if the two states are in the same phase, it's natural to expect that the two states are similar. So this overlap should be, you know, not so too distant from one. On the contrary, if they are on opposite, different phases, I expect it to be small, okay? So that's the very basic idea And I will prove, I mean, I will show how this idea works in practice, or if it works at all. There is something nice about this idea. There's a nice interpretation. So you, in terms of measuring states, I don't want to spend so much about this, so I will skip this. So, and here is, I explain a little bit more in the detail. So what's the point? To be more precise, the space of pure states, let's say we stick to zero temperature, okay? So our states are not really vectors, they're rays in Hilbert space. So in this space of rays, the projective space, there is a natural distance, okay? This is called the Fubini study distance, and it's given by this arcosine of the fidelity. So what I would like to do is to measure the distance between the two states according to Fubini study in this sense, okay? Now, since I have a distance, it's natural. I mean, once you would like, what comes very naturally is to look the distance for nearby points, and so which end up in defining a metric. No? You do this, so basically you consider your this lambda encodes all your the parameters that define your Hamiltonian, so it can be field, the temperature, or other coupling constants, and so on. You slightly move them a little bit of a point, and your distance in parameter space defines a tensor, okay, a metric tensor. If you work out the definition, this turns out to be the second derivative, basically, the Hessian of the fidelity, which I wrote before. And it has this explicit form in terms of the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian. Okay? This is something which looks familiar to condensed matter people because it reminds of the susceptibility which I wrote before, okay? So now let's go back again to our expectation. So we said that we expect that when we cross criticality, the fidelity should show a drop in turns, basically given by this. Because of this equation, we expect that the metric G should increase, okay? And so is this true? Well, to prove this, basically, you have to go through a series of results. One result is this one, which we proved. And you can state it as in form of a really precise, rigorous theorem. So you can show that if you are in a regular point of the phase diagram, this quantity here, this metric tensor, is going to be extensive in the system size. Okay. Instead, if you are at a critical point, you can put in all the machinery of scaling hypothesis, which comes from the normalization group and so on. So you get, I don't call it a theorem because, I mean, this machinery is, you know, it's sound in the sense that it predicts the physics very well, but difficult to make it really rigorous for more mathematical audience. Anyway, using scaling hypothesis, you get that at critical points, you get a behavior which can be, so can deviate from extensive by an exponent L to the Q. Okay? So, well, cool. This is exactly what we expected. Okay? If this exponent Q is positive, we get that normally this scales extensively, but at critical points, this scales more than extensively. Okay? Which would show up in a drop in the fidelity, or a sharp increase in this. So if you want, you can renormalize by the volume. So this would go to a constant, but at critical point, this constant will diverge. Okay? Well, nice, but we actually also learned something by this calculation, that this quantity here is not always positive. So it can also be negative. So there are some transition where this behavior is more subtle. Anyway, let's now compare a little bit this approach, let's say, to the more standard approach, which was based on susceptibilities. Okay? So you see, once again, the similarity between these two things. But you notice, of course, here the denominator is square, right? So at critical points, you expect that the energy gaps are going to zero, so this denominator here are going to zero, but this is going to zero faster, so this is somehow going to diverge more strongly. In fact, you can do, so on the hand of the scaling hypothesis, you can really predict precisely the kind of divergence that you expect, and you relate all these coefficients to the critical exponent which defines your theory. No? So D is the dimension of your system, Z is the so-called dynamical exponent, and this delta V is the scaling dimension of this operator here. So in fact, the susceptibility in the so-called quasi-critical region, so you are close to the critical point, but the correlation length is much larger than the system size. So effectively, your system feels as if it was infinite, because the correlation length is so large that it doesn't feel a correlation length at all. And these are the, on the other hand, if you are in the thermodynamic limit, so you first send the system size to infinity, and you see how your quantity scale with your parameters. Again, the divergence is stronger for this, which I call fidelity method. So this thing here is more divergent, and back again, I can write back my fidelity, which shows the expected behavior which was observed in one case by Anderson, but this is now generalized to all critical points. Okay, so the fidelity would have this general form with this exponent that you can predict somehow. So what can you do with the fidelity? Okay, I will try to show that you can actually do a lot of things, and people are doing a lot of things. One possibility that I would like to stress here is to measure crossover. Crossover in condensed matter are generally very difficult to identify because there's no real singularity going on, but the system smoothly somehow varies from one behavior to another, okay? So normally it's difficult. And this kind of crossover is observed, for instance, if you consider the phase diagram of critical theory, but now you add also temperature. So this is the famous Ising model, which has been studied quite a lot. And you also consider temperature. So you know from Sachdev books that this is the behavior in the phase diagram, including temperature and field. Okay, this is the quantum critical point at zero temperature. The influence of this quantum critical point extends also at positive temperature in this region here, sometimes called the quasi-critical region. And instead, in this region here, your behavior can be described more in classical terms. This is what you would get if you apply such the idea blindly. So you get these straight lines extend indefinitely, right? But actually, my model here is invariant under flip of a sign of H. So if I change H into minor H, the model stays the same. So this cannot be the case. There must be some reflection symmetry around the axis. So one possibility is you compute now the fidelity metric, which I told you before, and you consider the eigenvector of the maximal eigenvalue. So this gives you the direction of maximal distinguishability of your state. So it's precisely what I was doing. What I was telling you before is the direction in parameter space where your state changed most. So this is the direction where you expect your crossover to take place, okay? And this is the vector field. I don't know if you can see it clearly. It comes out of here. I didn't plot this part because it's reflection symmetric. So now if you take, let's say, blindly, I didn't know anything from my model. I just compute this G. And now out of this G is clearly that the phase diagram should going to be something like that. And this is, in fact, really the phase diagram for this model, and not really this one, because actually here there's a line of classical points. Okay, this is one application. Actually, this was also applied to BEC, BCS crossover. But let me I don't have time to summarize all the aspects where this calculation comes about, but just try to mention some. So these things, which sounds, I mean, in this context is a bit abstract, and it's a way to formulate the theory of phase transition in a geometric sense, so it can be appealing, but it has applications. One application was actually known long ago in the theory of Fermi edge singularity. Basically, what you do is, if you have a metal and you shine a very high energetic photon to an X-ray, the result is that you excite a core electron, so an electron which dips very close to the nuclei, right? This core electron produces a hole which modifies the one-body potential that the electrons are feeling, okay? So this is precisely more or less the situation that Anderson was studying. So you have a ground state, or one situation is a band, and the next situation is a band with one impurity. So not surprisingly, so fidelity enters in this explanation, and basically you can explain the singularity which are observed in this absorption spectrum. Another, this has been studied, you know, this is in the 60s, 70s, up to now, still now. Another context is estimation theory, sometimes called quantum metrology, which is a theory that takes basically the Heisenberg uncertainty principle seriously and really ask, okay, if I really do a measurement on some observable, what is the ultimate limit given by the laws of quantum mechanics with which I can get the error, so this observable with a certain precision. So in other words, what's the minimum error which is associated to some measurement? This minimum error is given by the quantum Fisher information, which is precisely this tensor G that I showed you before. Again, in another context, this is related to adiabatic quantum computation, because it enters in the adiabatic theorem. It's also the figure of merit in that case. And then I will show you another thing. It allows you to define new universal quantities, which are very nice and rare. Example of these universal quantities are central charge, everybody heard, and another one is the topological entropy, which was actually discovered for the first time by Alyosha. I will talk about it a bit later. But for some time, this fidelity approach has been used for something which I don't think is quite correct, so I would like to resolve this this issue somehow. I think there was a period in starting from 2004 or 5 where people were trying to look at or started looking at phase transition and entanglement. It was very compelling, the idea to see, the naive idea was the entanglement content at phase transition should be larger, right? Now we learned a lot, but anyway, some people thought it could be a good idea to pin down the transition to use some entanglement estimator. So you measure the entanglement between some parties and so on. And really numerically, let's say you solve your system, you get your data for some sizes, and they thought this could be a nice procedure to find the critical point. Similarly, also the fidelity could be used for this, and I mean, it produces results which are okay. You can extrapolate critical point in this way, but that's not the best thing you can do. Actually, it's quite funny that this problem, so finding critical points, which is there for almost forever, you know, if you look at Dohm and Grimm series, it occupies maybe a big fraction of the whole series. And there are methods out there to calculate critical points, but they are not particularly efficient, actually, if you study carefully. So I will instead provide an efficient method. This is the bottom line. So let me now open a digression. This is in these topics. This is really, so what happened, how, what, yeah, what are we talking about, let's say? Let's say we have our system has some sort of phase transition at some critical lambda, which is somewhere here, probably. And this, the standard expectation is, let's say, that some susceptibility will diverge at this transition. One prescription would be, okay, then I measure the susceptibility at finite size. It will, of course, it will show no divergence because everything is analytic, but it will probably be peaked, or will show a maximum not so far from the transition. So I collect this maximum for a certain finite size, then I increase the system size, I get this curve, I collect this maximum, then I increase the system size again, and I collect this maximum. These points here are called pseudo-critical points because they're not really critical points, they're at finite size. Criticality happens only in the thermodynamic limit, okay? What it happens is that these critical points scales to the pseudo-critical points, scales to the real critical point in an algebraic way with this exponent here, which is called the shift exponent. So, of course, this so you would like this shift exponent to be large. That's all you would like to be. So if this is large, then you have a method to extrapolate fast the critical point, let's say with short system size. I mean, this is important. You shouldn't spend $1 million to buy a supercomputer which adds two sites more to your chain if you can obtain the same results just by considering, shorter chains but using better algorithm in some sense. So what happens is that generally, in fact, all the methods which are most of the, please. I'm sorry. Theta, yes?
Because I see zero.
Oh, I'm sorry. It should be theta. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is this shift exponent.
Okay.
The PDF. Anti-aliasing was very strong in this. It's not zero. No, no, no. It's, I mean, zero would be a very bad algorithm.
Yeah, I was worried.
So generally, most of the times, this theta is related to the exponent nu, which is the one which gives you the divergence of the correlation length. Okay. So the most famous methods, now I give you a review of a known method. Actually, the most famous method in statistical mechanics, not quantum, let's say you want to find the critical point of the three-dimensionalizing model, you use Binder-Cumulant. It's the fourth order reduced Binder-Cumulant. Okay. And this is the equation which defines this pseudo-critical point, but don't worry, I mean, you don't have to go into the detail. This produces a sixth exponent, which is 1 over nu, let's say the standard expectation, in fact. See, this is also very important in, lattice gauge theories. These methods will become very valuable. So in quantum mechanics, there is another method which is based on the fact that you look for the point where the gap closes, basically. Okay? This is, for some reason, this has been called phenomenological renormalization group method for PRG. Okay, in quantum mechanics, you get a slightly better improvement. This is an epsilon, it's not a C. Okay, something a little bit better than 1 over nu, but nothing better. Okay, then we produced, this was another method. It's slightly better again, but not great. Fidelity, if you look at the maxima of the fidelity, they also give you the same shift from 1 over nu. And most probably, if you look at some entanglement measure, some reverse, you will get 1 over nu, so nothing great. So can we do better? Can we find something better? Actually, yes. You have to do that, you have to look carefully into the scaling form of the, let's say, your free energy or energy density. This is all these terms. Okay, don't be bothered too much. These terms somehow are predicted by the normalization group. This is the relevant variable to look at. So this is the form, the relevant variable that you look at in the quasi-critical region. So we noticed that there is one term which is normally not, accounted for, and it produces a correction, which in turn turns out to be responsible for this 1/nu that you get most of the time. So if you can hook up an algorithm that where this thing cancels, then you obtain a method which is faster. And the nice thing is that you know the dimension of this. This is always the dimension d plus z. So it's not some crazy exponent which depends on the irrelevant constant of your theory, you know. But it's you know this exponent. You can reproduce. This is the way to understand why there is such a term in the scaling is related to this Cardi formula, but you don't have to go into the detail. So basically, now I give you this method. You just compute, let's say we are in quantum mechanics, but the method can be generalized also to classical statistical mechanics at finite temperature. Simply compute the ground state excitation value, so your finite-size energy for a given size, and possibly this is the value of the perturbation at finite size. You could come in some form, okay, either this or this, and you get a shift point which is now much larger than the previous one. Is it large, or am I telling you, or the improvement is so tiny? Well, let's see. Yes. This is the equation which the, so you have to we found two methods. So with one you just need to compute the ground state energies, and then you put this partial derivative with respect to L, you just interpret it as a finite difference derivative. So you compute this equation, basically. You put in your, this has the disadvantage that you should know in this Z, the scaling dimension here in advance. Normally this can be obtained, but if you don't want to bother about that, there is another method where you also have to calculate this average, slightly more complicated, but not so much. These are all. Not really. I mean, yes. Somehow, yes. The improvement comes from knowing this scaling form, and to cook up a method which cancels out that term. And to do that, you have to be clever, like, I add this term, I subtract this term, and in the end, you get these equations. So the equation is not so illuminating, right, if you look at it. But this you don't know. This is dictated by some irrelevant field of your theory. Some people are interested in these numbers, but you cannot predict in advance. So let's see. Okay. The first thing, you test your model on a case where you can solve everything exactly. This model has been extensively studied. It's nice because in that case, you can obtain really the scaling function. This is the energy at finite size and around the critical point. Okay, so in the quasi-critical region, you expand. It's nice how you get this formula, but I will spare you the details. You get the nice Euler gamma number. And basically from here you can read off everything, okay? So you read off that, okay, the dimension is one, these exponents are one. So the standard methods give you one, not so nice. The PRG is better, 3, and our method give you 4. Okay, it's better. But is this work only for exactly solvable models? Well, let's do some numerics on some spin 1 non-integrable model. It's known that it has some phase transition at some points. And these are the data we collected. So this is another method which didn't talk about. This would be the reference method, so looking at the gaps, the closing of the gaps. And these are the two methods which we propose here. So the shift exponent in this case is 7.6 against 1.5. So you can see, I mean, once you have these numbers, you can limit yourself to very small, very short chains, and you can get a very good value from your critical points. If you have these numbers here, I mean, it's difficult to say what the critical point would be. Please.
From the crossing of the Binder cumulon, because I would claim that the Binder cumulon, the fourth order Binder cumulon, can detect this transition on easily that small size of systems, right? The Binder cumulon is a scale invariant crossing right at the critical point.
Yes.
Almost no subleading corrections to it.
No,
it's
no,
universal,
no.
Right?
It's the same. It's one over. Normally you don't. We didn't use it here because you don't use Binder cumulon in quantum systems. You could do that. You could do that. You could do that even in a quantum system. But normally, so the PRG would be better in this case. But I mean, you're right. I didn't do the check because it's basically known that in quantum mechanics it's better to use the PRG.
There's a L of the one over nu.
Yes.
Scaling.
Yes.
Yeah. This is the order.
It's not particularly
the parameter or the order parameter cumulon.
The perturbation, right? I mean, because you have to look. I mean, you have to reason in a way that you don't know much about the system. Of course, if you know everything, you know, there is a duality transformation. You can guess the.
In that sense, because you don't have to know the symmetry breaking of the order.
Yes, but it won't give you a precise. I mean, the fidelity will give you 1 over rho, so it will give you a number which is probably more than 1.5.
Very bad.
And actually, one more point. All these things, normally these methods breaks when you have a Costelli-Tauless transition where this nu goes to infinity, basically, right? This method, you can do a modified ANSAT in that case, and it works even in that case. And we actually did also numerics on a KT transition, and it worked, which is quite, this wasn't expected either. We didn't expect that either.
So, nice. So fidelity is nice. So it gives you
nice insight about many things. But if you want to pin down transition point, you should use accelerated nets. So now I wanted to spend the last few minutes about telling you how you can exploit the fidelity to find out new universal quantities. So universal quantities, in some sense you get them very easily. You just have, critical point, there is scale invariance, you get a bunch of universal critical exponents. These are kind of boring numbers, right? Don't tell you much about what's going on. Yes, sometimes people are interested. Is it 2.6 or 2.61, the exponent? But who cares, right? So some other constants are much more intriguing for us, at least. So one of these constants is the central charge, which I mentioned before. And one way this pops up in 1+1 conformal field theories, in other words, in one-dimensional quantum mechanical system in this way. So the energy density of a conformal field theory would scale extensively, of course. The next leading correction is 1 over L, so you know this power. And the coefficient here is this C times a velocity, so you have to know this velocity also. But the C tells you a lot about the behavior of your theory. That's amazing. Similar thing, the Fournier topological entropy. So the topological entropy of our ordered states, now we're talking about a two-dimensional region with boundary L. Again, if you are in a topologically ordered state, you get term which goes with the area. And then the next leading term is this gamma here, which was, as I said, found by first Alyosha and other guys, and then beautifully elaborated by these other people. And this is so far the only really order parameter for this topological state. So this is, again, another very important quantity. So do we get something like that in our fidelity thing? Well, let's see. Now, let's consider back again the scalar product of these two wave functions at different coupling. And now the coupling can be far apart. They don't need to be close to each other, okay? But what I'm going to show you is that morally this thing is some sort of free energy. So it makes sense to take the log, basically. And you will see, you can imagine you expand the powers of your system size, you will get, let's say, a volume term, log, and boundary terms, possibly, okay, depends on that. And then, let's say you encounter some term which is of order one, but basically, this term will be universal. It will have a, what does it mean, universal? It means that it depends only on the effective critical, an effective theory of my system, and not on the detail, you know, the macroscopic details of, say, second nearest neighbor interaction or things like that, but only on the effective theory in the renormalization group sense. Why is this? This will be universal, but basically this expansion, it should be dimensionless, so this is actually an expansion of L over A, if you want, of the infrared and the ultraviolet cutoff of your theory. So this term has no either ultraviolet or infrared cutoff. So it really depends only on the effective theory. And possibly the boundary condition defining your problem. Okay? So let's first I want to convince you that such an expansion is what you will find. And to do that, I will exploit this correspondence between d-dimensional quantum mechanics and d plus one statistical mechanics, right? It's well known, the correspondence is made by the transfer matrix in this sense, okay? Transfer matrix would be e to the minus h, basically, where h is your quantum Hamiltonian. This is a way you can obtain your state. Now becomes your imaginary time axis, and L was your system size. So one way to get the ground state is in this way, okay? It's just a path integral, if you want. So now, with this formula, you can write the scalar product in this way. So these two denominators are partition function of classical system, where the coupling is specified by lambda 1 or lambda 2. The numerator is this classical system, where the coupling in this region are given by lambda 1, and the coupling in this region are given by lambda 2. And here, at the boundary, they change abruptly. Okay? So there is a way now to deal with such things. So basically, what you can do, you fold your model in such a way that your fields, which are defined here and here, they become defined in the same region of space. But then these two fields don't interact. There's no interaction. So the only interaction remains here at this boundary point, okay? This boundary point here. So this is these two fields and boundary point. Remember that in the end, I want to send m to infinity, this size here. So this size here goes to infinity. So you can basically go back to a scalar product description. And these two, so the effect of these two free states somehow is encoded in this, becomes encoded in this omega states, which gives these two not interacting theories. And the effect of the boundary here is encoded in a so-called boundary states, B. Okay? And this has led to the, if your theory is critical and conformal, you can basically classifying these boundary states. And then you can compute these things just by, in pretty much the same way as you classify conformal transformation, you classify boundary conformal transformation. Please.
So the boundary has
a protective order. In my case, it has no vertex or border. You would get other corrections in this case, yes.
So this theory was done by these guys here, and basically was predicted, in fact, that there was a universal term in that case. So again, we recover what we anticipated. So let's see how this works. So let's say you could compute this on a simple theory, a free boson theory, so-called C equal 1, or Lottinger liquid in condensed matter. And this is, in some sense, this is free, so you can compute all these quantities quite easily, and you obtain the result that I could call this topological fidelity in some sense, because it depends on the topology and on the universality. In a simple exercise, you would get this number. Is this really universal? So does it, let's see how universal it is. And this, I think, is very one of these beautiful emergence of universality. So you can consider, this is another famous one, the lattice model, XX dead. So it's a deformation of the Heisenberg chain, where you put an anisotropy here. And it's known that the effective model of this theory is this continuum field theory. Okay. Moreover, so matching both Bethe-Andert and bosonization, we know exactly the behavior which ties this delta here to this coupling constant here, or if you want, the compactification radius of your theory. Well, you can calculate this topological fidelity in this framework. You have to be, it's not easy, so you do exact diagonalization on some system size, bam, you get your numbers, and you get these crosses here. On the other hand, you can do the calculation in this case. As I showed before, it's quite easy. You get these numbers. Then you compare your results, and you see that, the agreement is beautiful. And what is maybe even more astonishing is these are data obtained with up to 20 spins, chains with only 20 spins. Do you really see the emergence of universality of an effective quantum field theory with a chain with 20 spins, which would say, come on, this is finite dimensional Hilbert space, it's pretty far from a field theory. Not really. Some things are matching very well. And again, this actually also depends on the boundary condition. So if you change the boundary condition of your chain and don't use periodic, you can induce antiperiodic boundary condition for the fields of your theory here, the phi, in such a way that in the end you have no topological fidelity anymore. So this depends also on the topology that you choose to give to your field. You can generalize this to other situations, like consider, for instance, one state of these two is, let's say, for a very large value of the anisotropy, this would be the ground state. And, this would induce this kind of boundary condition on the field. If you talk to Robert Salleur, he will tell you that this topological fidelity, so in some case, Dirichlet boundary condition is given by this term. So you make the algebra, and that's the result. Again, the agreement is very good. I think I should stop here. So that's my summary. Yeah, so fidelity is, it's nice. You can set up a framework for critical points. And you can do actually a lot of physics, adiabatic quantum computation, estimation theory. You can also apply it to equilibration issues and so on. But if you want to find a critical point, use something else, not that. And then I also mentioned this appearance of topological fidelity. Thank you very much for your attention. Actually, I mean, something I didn't show you here.
The place where you expect this topological fidelity to be present are critical theories with the marginal operator, which are deformable theories. So one possibility was the boson model, let's say. And another possibilities are similarly constructed theories, Lifshitz, there's a way, I think was introduced by Trapkin. Basically, it's a sort of matrix flow of states where you put the weights of your wave function are given by the partition function of a two-dimensional, let's say, eight-vertex model or six-vertex model and so on. The field theory, which corresponds to that, is some Lifshitz theory. Now you're in two dimensions, so in two quantum dimensions, so it's a 2+1 theory. And again, there is a marginal operator in that case, and you can do also the calculation there, and it turns out that it's there. But no, topological order state, I don't think.
It might be a critical theory.
So a gap phase. Yeah. I mean, it's not if and only if. You know that if it's critical, it will be there. I don't know about the. This may be.
Questions? So let's thank you very much.